5 hours West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Kurdish officials in northeast Syria are expected to declare a federal system in areas they control. The announcement could come as early as Thursday, following a conference in Kurdish-held territory. U.S. spokesman Mark Toner Wednesday said Washington will not recognize self-rule in the semi-autonomous zone.
We are focused on advancing a negotiated political transition towards an inclusive government that is capable of serving the interests of all the Syrian people. We've also been very clear that we're committed to the unity and territorial integrity of Syria. But ultimately, how that looks is going to be a process that's going to have to be decided by the Syrian people as they move forward.
The plan has also been rejected by Damascus. The Kurds are currently excluded from the Geneva peace process on Syria's political future. The Syrian Kurdish YPG militia has been an important ally of the U.S.-led military campaign against Islamic State. The Kurdish plan is to unite three Kurdish-led autonomous areas of Syria. The death toll from the attack on hotels Sunday in Grand Bassam in the Ivorian Beach Resort has risen to 19 after a body washed ashore. At least three gunmen affiliated with the Al-Qaeda North Africa branch were killed by security forces in Sunday's attack. Wednesday, President Alassane Ouattara vowed the attack would not derail the country's post-war revival. Niger's opposition presidential candidate Hama Amadou was taken from his Niamey jail cell Wednesday, flown to a Paris hospital 4 days before a runoff election. Amadou has been in jail since November on baby trafficking charges, allegations he and his supporters deny. Amadou plans to have his name on the ballot Sunday, even though his opposition coalition will boycott. It says the results of the first round were grotesque and cooked up. They were won by President Mahamudu Issoufou. This is VOA News. The White House says President Obama will deliver a historic address to the Cuban people Tuesday at the end of his visit to the communist-ruled island nation. The speech to be delivered at the Grand Theater in Havana is expected to lay out a vision of greater freedom and economic opportunity for the Cuban people. The trip, which begins Sunday, will be the first by a sitting U.S. president in nearly 90 years. Cuba analyst Ted Henkin of Baruch College in New York was asked about the importance of the trip.
Well, I think this will be another step, but a very significant symbolic one, to legitimize in Cuba the existence of a civil society that's not controlled by the Cuban government, although it's not necessarily opposed to the Cuban government. In most cases, it's probably not. But it's an alternative, and it makes up this wide array of diverse citizen organizations and opinions and groups and activities.
Mr. Obama will meet Cuban President Raul Castro and is expected to also hold talks with Cuban dissidents. Human Rights Watch has called on the U.S. leader to call for concrete measures to end systematic repression in Cuba. The White House Wednesday denounced the sentencing of an American university student to 15 years hard labor in North Korea for trying to steal a propaganda banner from a hotel. Josh Earnest is a White House spokesman.
The allegations for which this individual was arrested and imprisoned would not give rise to arrest or imprisonment in the United States or in just about any other country in the world. Now, despite official claims that U.S. citizens arrested in North Korea are not used for political purposes, it is increasingly clear that the North Korean government seeks to use these U.S. citizens as pawns to pursue a political agenda.
The 21-year-old University of Virginia student Otto Warmbier was arrested in January as he tried to leave the country with a tour group. Meanwhile, President Obama Wednesday signed an executive order imposing new sanctions on Pyongyang following its latest nuclear and ballistic missile tests. The U.S. Central Bank says it's keeping a key interest rate steady for the time being. Janet Yellen, chairman of the Federal Reserve, said slow global growth poses risks to the U.S. economy.
Proceeding cautiously in removing policy accommodation at this time will allow us to verify that the labor market is continuing to strengthen despite the risks from abroad.
But she also made it clear officials will probably raise rates later this year. The U.N. has condemned Morocco's decision to reduce its contingent to a peacekeeping force in Western Sahara. The move underscores tensions following UN Chief Ban Ki-moon's criticism of Rabat's annexation of the former Spanish territory in 1975 as an occupation. Botswana's highest court Wednesday rejected an attempt by the government to ban a homosexual rights group from registering and lobbying for change in legislation. Homosexuality is a crime in the country. Judge Ian Kirby said the government action interferes in the fundamental right to form an association to protect and promote one's interests. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. People in several African countries are unhappy, according to the 2016 World Happiness Report.
The report actually identifies that there are six things that contribute. The single biggest driver is easily GDP per capita or income. The other five are trust, life expectancy, social support, freedom, and generosity.
John Clifton is managing partner with the U.S.-based global research company Gallup. There is an international effort to reduce Africa food insecurity. Sierra Leone's special court rearrests a war crimes convict, and a Kenyan civil society group calls on the government to declare corruption a national disaster.
One of the things that I think is very indicative that the government is not serious about fighting corruption is the manner in which now the government has weakened the Anti-Corruption Commission.
James Mwamu is a leading member of the East African Law Society. South Sudan government and rebels are accused of violating the ceasefire, and Zimbabwe's High Court makes a ruling on a diamond mining company. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. People in a number of African countries, including Burundi, Benin, Rwanda, Guinea, Liberia, Tanzania, Madagascar, and Togo, are the least happy people in the world, according to the 2016 World Happiness Report. John Clifton is managing partner with the U.S.-based global research company Gallup, which prides itself on delivering relevant, timely, and visionary research on what humans around the world think and feel. He says the report took into consideration GDP per capita, life expectancy, corruption, social support, and freedom to make life choices as indicators of happiness.
The report actually identifies that there are six things that contribute. The single biggest driver is easily GDP per capita or income. The other five are trust, life expectancy, social support, freedom, and generosity.
Let's say, for example, Liberia came out of a civil war and has had two consecutive terms of a democratic presidency. So what factors do you think would be, would they be economic, or would that probably give Liberia a low score?
Well, the other thing is Ebola made things really challenging because a lot of well-being within a country can be determined by recent events. So even when we look outside of the very low scores that people gave their lives when they were asked to evaluate it on a scale of 0 to 10, when we ask them things about whether or not they experienced a lot of sadness or anger or physical pain, Liberia is among the top 10 in the world for that particular metric. And even when we switch to positive emotions, asking about whether or not they had a lot of fun the previous day, laughed and smiled a lot or experienced a lot of enjoyment, they rank in the bottom 20 for that particular metric. So a lot of it can be event-driven by things like Ebola they experienced, because our interviews were actually conducted mid of last year.
As I was going through some of the readings about it, it seems to me there are two or so African countries that made some progress. Any progress at all?
Definitely, but let me just focus on exactly where a big strength that Africa has. And that comes through what we call social support, one of these six things that's contributing to how people evaluate your life. And the way that we measure social support is that we ask people, if you were in trouble, do you have relatives or friends you can count on to help you whenever you need them or not? And what we found is that in 36 countries where we conducted these surveys last year, in 33 of them, over a majority of people said yes to that. So there's a huge strength among Africa when it comes to social support. You know, the other thing, though, is there is something that's dragging on Africa, and it's not just, you know, lower levels of GDP per capita and income. Another big drag that's happening all throughout Africa is corruption, at least perceived corruption within government. So, for example, we ask people all throughout Africa, is corruption widespread through the government in this country or not? And we were able to ask that question in 34 different countries. And in 30 of those countries, 50% or more of people said that they believed corruption was widespread throughout their governments.
I was looking at, say, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi, these countries. They not do that well also.
That's right.
For example, Rwanda, would it be the same factors that you just described?
Well, Rwanda is a bit of an outlier. Because surprisingly, as we all know, Rwanda has been referred to as the Singapore of Africa. But when it comes to how people see their lives, they're not doing as well, particularly when compared to their GDP per capita. So Rwanda is a bit of an anomaly that I think is worth further explanation because people see their lives worse than they should, quite frankly.
John Clifton is managing partner with the U.S.-based global research company Gallup. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. A leading member of the East African Law Society has welcomed calls for the Kenyan government to declare corruption in public institutions a national disaster. James Muamu says the declaration could help both the government and citizens to fight corruption in a united front. His remarks came after officials of the Institute of Certified Public Accountants in Kenya called on the government to declare corruption a national disaster at an annual governance and ethics conference held in the coastal town of Mombasa. In this interview with reporter Peter Clotty, Muamu called on the Kenyan government to demonstrate a serious commitment about weeding out corruption in all public institutions.
It now appears that corruption in Kenya has been officially sanctioned. One of the things that I think is very indicative that the government is not serious about fighting corruption is the manner in which now the government has weakened the Anti-Corruption Commission. The people who have been appointed there, I think, basically report to the office of the president. It therefore means that corruption now must be declared as a national disaster. I do not even think that even if the government right now declares a national disaster, that is going to help us. Because I think the very government is not serious about fighting corruption. People are being taken to court with investigations are surely done. At the end of the day, they are left because there are no proper evidence presented in court, and therefore the courts are therefore left to make conclusions that are not in tandem with the wishes and the desires of the people of Kenya. And
some people are saying that Kenyans themselves have dabbled in this corruption and are not demanding accountability from those they voted into power. And that is why the vicious cycle of corruption keeps on going on unabated. What is your stance on that?
To some extent, that is right, because you find that even the people who have voted in office, a lot of money gets involved when people are campaigning. And by and large, I think sometimes to a certain extent, it's like buying votes. This actually has resulted in cheapening the national psyche so that the person with a lot of money and people don't ask where it is coming from is the one that is voted in office. People are now condoning this thing as a way of life, and I think it is something that we as Kenyans need to think very seriously as to when the rain began falling on us.
What institutions of governance can this strengthening that you're talking about be done to ensure that this menace is swept out or weeded out in Kenyan geopolitical and economic issues, since the accountants are saying that this is a national disaster that needs to be tackled head on?
One of the things that was weakened by parliamentarians was the EACC, that is the anti-corruption body. I think more legislative powers need to strengthen and cushion that body because it was probably weakened. Right now, I think it is a tool of the executive. It is not as independent as we thought. And so we think that there's need to amend the law to make EACC as more independent as possible. The other thing which I think is that the appointment of EACC, they should be given security or tenure. Right now, they don't have a security or tenure. If anybody wants to remove them, they'll just go with a bill in parliament and remove them.
James Muamu is a leading member of the East African Law Society. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 17th. And let's send a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Sky 106.6 FM in Freetown, Sierra Leone, and KISS FM 104 in Bole, Sierra Leone. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Sierra Leone's UN-backed special court has rearrested a war crimes convict. Muinina Fofana had been released from jail as part of an early release agreement. But as Kelvin Lewis reports from Freetown, the court has started hearings on allegations that Mr. Fofana breached the conditions for his release.
Dressed in a flowing dark brown African gown, war crimes convict Moinina Fofana listened attentively as the three alleged violations of his conditional release were read out to him. Asked why Fofana had been rearrested, Special Court Registrar Binta Mansari says Fofana broke the rules he had agreed to honor.
The president of the court imposed several conditions on Mr. Fofana while he was serving the remainder of his sentence in his community, Bo. And one of such conditions is that he must not join local politics, but also that he was placed on a schedule, a reporting schedule, twice every month. It appears as if he has not been complying with those conditions.
Fofana appeared before Justice Vivian Solomon and denied all of the allegations. He denied he had been involved in politics by attending the Youth League Congress of the ruling All People's Congress Party in Makini. Fofana also denied he had failed to return to his hometown, Bo, after he had obtained permission to go to Freetown and had instead traveled to Makini for an occasion which was not approved by the monitoring authority. Special Court Registrar Binta Mansari says this is not a criminal trial.
This is an administrative hearing. The reason it's not judicial, because, again, it does not involve any criminal conduct on the part of Mr. Moinina Fofana. So the judge will hear the matter to determine whether indeed Mr. Fofana is in breach of one or more of his conditions of release.
Fofana was part of a paramilitary unit involved in torturing and killing civilians accused of supporting rebels in the country's 11-year civil war, which ended in 2002. He was convicted on four counts of murder, cruel treatment, pillage, and collective punishment, and sentenced to 15 years by the UN-backed Special Court for Sierra Leone. He was sent to serve his sentence in a jail in Rwanda, since it was deemed that Sierra Leone did not have the appropriate facilities to jail him. Fofana was released in 2015 on good behavior after having served two-thirds of his sentence. On 12 March 2015, Fofana was returned to Sierra Leone to finish the remainder of his term under a conditional early release agreement. Justice Solomon has ordered him to remain in the custody of the residual special court till another hearing on Friday. Fofana is due to finish his sentence in May 2018. For VOA, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from Freetown.
United Nations agencies and African governments are meeting to develop strategies to reduce food losses among smallholder farmers. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, Africa is grappling with higher than normal rates of food insecurity due to drought and flooding caused in large part by El Nino.
The United Nations is helping governments from across Africa to find ways to reduce food losses on the continent. A week-long meeting in Harare is being attended by UN agencies such as the Food and Agriculture Organization. The FAO's Stefan Galatova says a third of the food produced on the continent is lost before it is consumed due to poor storage facilities, resulting in it rotting or pests feeding on it. She says meeting participants are prioritizing steps to reduce the waste.
We're not targeting all commodities. We've selected those that have been prioritized by the government. In many southern African countries, the priority is maize. We're also conducting several studies on horticultural crops, both fruits and vegetables. A few studies on milk. In West Africa, there's a lot of interest in reducing fish losses. The El Nino is more about affecting production and productivity. But of course, El Nino plays a big role in this, because if you don't produce the food in the first place, then, you know, there's nothing to protect.
El Nino-induced drought has hit most parts of the Horn of Africa and Southern Africa. This week, Zimbabwe announced that about 4 million people need food handouts because of drought, while UNICEF said it was looking for at least $21 million to avert malnutrition in the Southern African nation. At Mbare Musika Market in Harare, almost all agricultural commodities such as maize, bananas, tomatoes, and nuts are found. But farmers say they lose most of their produce before they get buyers. Tomato farmer Grace Chikwana says besides pest, her crop perishes because she fails to secure timely transport.
When I come here, when the tomatoes are high priced, I make money. But the market, they don't have fixed price with tomatoes.
Robert Delve is a technical advisor with the International Fund for Agricultural Development. He says rural farmers in Africa should be taught about adding value to their produce by processing or learning methods to reduce loss, but he says IFAD funding for low-interest loans and direct assistance has fallen. Sebastian Mhofu for VOA News, Harare.
A ceasefire monitoring body in South Sudan says government and opposition forces violated the permanent ceasefire at least five times in the last 3 months and prevented monitors from gaining access to areas of conflict. Philipton Alel reports for VOA from Juba.
Rose Pini, communications officer for the ceasefire and transitional security arrangements monitoring mechanism, says representatives from the government and opposition talk about continued violations of the permanent ceasefire by both sides at today's meeting. Finney says the parties reported 8 clashes between December 28th and this month, but only 5 of those violations were confirmed by the ceasefire and transitional security arrangements monitoring mechanism officials. They occurred mainly in the former Western Equatoria, Western Bahr al-Ghazal, and Greater Upper Nile region.
It is inappropriate for us to comment on the details of these allegations and who is implicated. But today, both parties were implicated in the violation reports that were tabled for discussion.
Finney says the specific areas of violations and the parties responsible for these violations have been provided to the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the body overseeing the implementation of the peace agreement. She says the monitoring and verification team has also raised concerns about the denial of access to where fighting is reported.
It's really an ongoing thing. We're not having more difficulty in one area or another. Across the board, we're facing restrictions on our movement, which is in, you know, it doesn't comply at all with the Chapter 2 stipulations.
Chapter 2 of the Peace Agreement on Security Arrangement requires both parties to allow unimpeded access to ceasefire monitors. Pini says the government and opposition representatives promised to report to their superiors so those restrictions are removed. She says the government and the SPLM in opposition were also asked during the meeting to declare the number of their forces, weaponry, and specific areas of cantonments. She says this information will help the ceasefire and transitional security arrangement monitoring mechanism to easily monitor the deployment of forces and monitor the ceasefire. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
The Zimbabwe High Court has ruled that Mdada Diamonds, which is among several firms that were ordered by the state to stop operations in Manicaland province, can only deploy security guards at its mining compounds but cannot resume diamond mining activities due to lack of a proper license to mine the gems. The government shut down mining activities in Maringe Diamond Fields and others last month, claiming the companies had no licenses and refused to be part of a national diamond mining entity designed to take over all operations in the region. Thomas Cheripasi reports from Harare.
Harare High Court Judge Joseph Mafusire ruled that Mbada Diamonds was wrongfully dispossessed of its property when police details were deployed to guard the Marange diamond fields following the government's directive for all the diamond mining companies to stop all mining activities in Manicaland province. This ruling was confirmed by Advocate Louis Uriri, one of the lawyers representing the police in this matter.
The learned judge handed down his judgment this morning, where he finds that, in fact, Bada was wrongfully dispossessed of the property in question. He orders restoration subject to the fact that Bada will not be able to mine or to conduct any operations on the mine, in view of the fact that the licenses had expired. That means that technically they were wrongfully removed, which position we don't agree with and which position we are in fact appealing. It also means that they cannot mine, they cannot undertake any operations on the ground. Until, according to the judge, when the question of the validity of their mining licenses is determined.
Uriri, however, said the state was going to appeal against the court's decision, arguing that authorities followed provisions of the law when they removed the diamond companies from their concessions.
Security personnel are entitled to remain on the ground just to make sure that nothing of their staff is removed. But we are basically saying that they were not despoiled. We gave them 90 days in terms of the act to remove their equipment, and we look forward to them removing their equipment. And to the extent that we don't agree with that finding, specific finding, we will appeal it to the Supreme Court.
The judge, however, found that Mbada Diamonds could not resume mining operations since the company had not renewed its operating license. Executives of Mbada Diamonds were not available for comment. Mines Minister Walter Chidakwa last month ordered the closure of all companies that were mining diamonds in Chiatswa on the basis that they had not renewed their operating licenses. This is Thomas Chiripasi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Nigeria and Ghana will get to know their preliminary round opponents at the FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup today, Thursday. The draws for the 16-nation contest take place in Port Moresby, the capital of Papua New Guinea. Meanwhile, FIFA is committed to reclaiming millions of dollars that were illegally diverted to private use by former FIFA officials. The FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland on Wednesday, casting FIFA as a victimized institution. Infantino says these former FIFA officials betrayed their position of trust. Infantino has submitted documents to the United States Department of Justice supporting his claims. The United States Department of Justice is investigating 41 former FIFA officials and their associates implicated in financial indiscretion. Turning to athletics, a total cash prize money over $2.4 million is up for grabs as more than 600 athletes begin vying for medals at the IAAF World Indoor Athletics Championships in Portland, Oregon State in the United States of America starting today, Thursday. Each gold medalist will earn $40,000. The other five finalists will earn $20,000, $10,000, $8,000, $6,000 and $4,000 respectively in descending order. Any athlete who sets a world record will earn a $50,000 bonus. The IAAF clarifies that prize money will only be disbursed after the mandatory doping tests. In handball, Tunisia gets a final chance to qualify for the women's handball event at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics when they compete in an international tournament in the French city of Metz starting tomorrow Friday. Tunisia play Japan tomorrow Friday before challenging hosts France on Saturday and Netherlands on Sunday. Tunisia aims to join African champions Angola, who have qualified for the Olympics. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Niger's opposition presidential candidate, Ahmed Amadou, was taken from his Niamey jail cell and flown to a Paris hospital on Wednesday, 4 days before a runoff election. Amadou has been in jail since November on baby trafficking charges, allegations that he and his supporters say are politically motivated. That's it for this Thursday, March 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butter saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Do you love sports? VOA Africa has more of what you love, an expanded Sunny Side of Sports show. More on-the-scene reports and analysis, plus what's trending in the sports world. Come to VOA Africa for the expanded half hour of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Remember, tune in starting Monday, March 21st, right here on VOA Africa.